You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today is the third episode in our series on Venetian traveler Marco Polo. Last time, we left the 21-year-old Marco standing before the mighty Kublai Khan. Marco's father said his son was the Khan's man, and the Mongol emperor was pleased. So today, we have two major tasks. The first is that we are going to do a dive into the world of Kublai Khan and the Mongol Empire. This will take a high-level look at the Mongol world and how it pertained to Marco Polo. Second, we are going to get Marco going as he starts to gallivant around Asia as an agent for Kublai Khan. Now, I do have three notes, because we can't have a show without some notes. First, I want to let everyone know that I did an interview with the folks at the History Hack podcast, and it is now available for you to hear. In the show, I talk about five explorers who I consider amongst history's finest. History Hack is a pretty amazing show. It is a daily podcast with the show's hosts joined each time by a variety of historical-related guests, such as myself. So check it out. The show is History Hack, and you can just do a search for it on your podcast app, or I put a link to the episode in the show notes as well. Second, I want to mention that I am trying to keep the story of Marco Polo rooted in fact. The guy talks about a lot of stuff in his book, but I'm keeping the fantasy stuff to a minimum. I'll drop you some of the more wild and interesting things Marco discusses, but I don't want to venture too far off the path of historical accuracy. Thus, I will not tell you the tale of how Genghis Khan defeated the legendary Prester John and conquered his kingdom. Seriously, Marco goes on at length about the stories he was told about the Christian realm led by Prester John. The story goes that the Khan asked for Prester John's daughter to wed and was refused. This started a war between the two kingdoms, with Prester John losing and his realm being swallowed by the Mongols. Good story, never happened. But it's one of those things that Marco dwells on quite a bit in his book, and it's all fantasy. It's probably a good example of Marco's biographer, Rusticello, saying, "Hey, everyone is fascinated by Prester John, so let's insert some fairy tale explaining why Marco never found the fabled Christian kingdom." Just know that there are all sorts of these kinds of things in Marco's book, but we will keep it to a minimum in this podcast. And that leads us to our third and final note. I want to mention something unique about the chronology of Marco Polo's journeys, and that is that there really isn't a chronology once he reaches the Great Khan. And what I mean by this is that Marco describes his travels throughout Asia, but the dates are very muddied, and it's possible his descriptions are combined, meaning if he went to a particular place two or three times, he only bothers to describe that journey once. To be honest, this stuff is kind of maddening. In history, we like to have rigid timelines, but that's just really hard with Marco Polo, other than getting to Khan Balik and then leaving. Everything else in between is kind of a big muddied mess. Because of this, when we speak about the travels of Marco Polo, we'll take his major expeditions and speak about them without really setting specific dates, unless it's possible. Just know that these travels occur between 1275 and 1291. Okay, that's it. Let's move on with the show. And that means a look at the world of Kublai Khan and the Mongol Empire. The Mongol Empire emerged in 1206 in Mongolia out of the unification of numerous nomadic tribes under the leadership of Genghis Khan. The Mongols were a warlike people who were experts in combat. The Mongol cavalry was considered the finest in the world. Under Genghis Khan and then his successors, the empire grew dramatically, pushing east and south. The Mongol army swept across China, the Middle East, and into Eastern Europe. It would eventually become the largest contiguous empire in the history of the world. Now, we've talked a bit about the Mongols in our past episodes, and one thing that we mentioned was that they were vicious when it came to empire building. And that is true. The Mongols were known to wipe out entire cities if they resisted, and Marco Polo had seen the result of this brutal policy in the Middle East, where once great cities had been reduced to ruins. So, after the death of Genghis Khan in 1227, his descendants would go on to rule an ever-expanding empire. There would be wars and civil wars and squabbles, but in 1260, Kublai Khan, the grandson of Genghis Khan, would rise to power after the death of his brother, Mong Khan. Another civil war would follow, but Kublai Khan would ultimately come out on top and solidify his position as emperor. He would continue to expand his realm and conquer all of China in the 1270s. Now, a couple of important points. First, the Mongol Empire was massive. It stretched from Europe to the Pacific Ocean. However, there were various regions that had an autonomous status within the empire. This included Mongol areas in Persia and Russia. The truth is, these areas had nominal allegiance to the Great Khan, but in reality, they were mostly independent political entities. This doesn't really play a big part in our story, but I did want to mention it. With that in mind, Kublai Khan maintained direct rule over much of what is China, Mongolia, and Tibet. Now, this is still massive, and it leads us to our point number two, and that is regarding China. For centuries, the Mongols had looked at China from the north with a mixture of envy and longing and lust. It was a rich and sophisticated land. Technology, education, the arts, architecture, philosophy, and commerce all flourished. For the nomadic Mongols, it was everything they dreamed of, and when they finally did conquer China, it was nothing short of extraordinary, almost unbelievable. Yet the Mongols had won, due to a variety of reasons, but most importantly, their outstanding military prowess. When all was said and done, Kublai Khan was left to administer a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious population stretching across thousands of miles. For many of the more far-flung areas, his regional administrators would handle much of the work. But for the Great Khan, at least in the time of Marco Polo, his attention was increasingly focused on China and its immediate neighbors. As part of that focus, Kublai Khan set out to remake himself and his administration in the image of China. The empire's capital was moved to Khanbaliq, which is modern-day Beijing. The Great Khan took to wearing Chinese clothing and adopted Chinese customs. He learned Chinese Buddhism and Confucianism and gave one of his sons a Chinese name. Writer Lawrence Bergreen called Kublai Khan, quote, the least Mongol of the Mongol rulers, end quote. Now, a big reason for all of this was that Kublai Khan understood that if he wanted to legitimize his status as the ruler of China, he had to maintain his base of power there, and he had to gain a certain level of acceptance from the Chinese people. This meant adapting to their customs. This meant not imposing the Mongol way of life on the populace. This meant showing tolerance of a variety of religions. All of this Kublai Khan did. And then, in 1271, he proclaimed himself the first emperor of the Yuan dynasty. This would eventually cover the areas of what is modern-day China, Mongolia, Tibet, and parts of southeastern Russia. In doing this, he was saying that the Mongols were here to stay. China was just not a place to loot, but an integral part of the empire. Now, I made a reference to religion a moment ago, and I want to expand on that. Kublai Khan and the Mongols were somewhat unique in that, at this time, they were not set on imposing religious rule over the peoples that they conquered. Yes, they had their own gods and mythology, but in a lot of ways, the Mongols were tolerant of other religions. A big reason for this is that they wanted to incorporate others into their empire, and allowing them to retain their religious identity made this much, much easier. This was not necessarily always the case, especially in the past, but Kublai Khan seems to have been pretty open about religion. In addition to the economic and political reasons for this, another reason probably lies in the fact that Kublai Khan's mother, Sor Gutani, was a Nestorian Christian. This all seems to have made Kublai Khan very interested and accepting of different religions. Thus, Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, Confucianism, and Christianity would mix in with the shamanism of the Mongols. It will make for a fascinating world for Marco Polo. Now, one thing I want to stress about Kublai Khan and the land of China is that while the Khan worked to weave himself into the Chinese world, he understood that he could never fully trust the Chinese. He would always worry about plots and rebellions from his Chinese lords, and thus he would want to keep them from gaining too much power in his court. This will work to the advantage of Marco Polo, as Kublai Khan often used foreigners for imperial business. There were advisors who were Persians and Muslims working right next to some who were Chinese. That means a clever and intelligent young Venetian would be a perfect candidate for a job with Kublai Khan's administration. But that's jumping a bit ahead in our story. Before we get to Marco's travels, I want to talk a little bit about the world that Marco Polo now inhabited, because it is quite extraordinary. So, it was May of 1275, and Marco Polo, along with his father and uncle, stood before the Great Khan. Niccolo Polo had essentially presented his son to Kublai Khan, saying Marco was now the Khan's servant. Marco would describe the Khan in his book, noting that he was about 60 years old and average in size, and he was presented as a robust man, which is not always the image we have of the guy. In his final decade of life, he would grow heavy, and many of the drawings we have of him show this fat guy. But that's not how Marco describes the man, at least initially. The great Khan was energetic and inquisitive. The latter term is something that really seems to strike a chord when describing Kublai Khan. He was a man who loved to learn things, loved to know stuff. It is a quality that will help him rule so effectively. Marco was clearly in awe of the great Khan and would constantly praise him. The Khan was wise and just and a great leader and warrior. Marco says, quote, "The title Khan means great lord of lords, and he certainly has right to this title," end quote. By the way, the brutality of Kublai Khan is often ignored or downplayed by Marco, but not always. The young Venetian is clearly enamored with the power and majesty that Kublai Khan wielded, and thus those pesky massacres and slaughters get little mention by Marco. So, Marco Polo would spend a lot of time at the court of Kublai Khan in Chengdu and Khanbalik. Chengdu, also called Xanadu, was the summer palace of the Khan and was about 150 miles north of Khanbalik. But both places were, according to Marco, astounding. He would go into detail about the palaces, the banquets, and the people. At Khanbalik, which was still being constructed in Marco's time, the palace had more than 400 rooms and a hall that could hold 6,000 people. There were huge, sumptuous celebrations on the Khan's birthday and leading up to the Mongol New Year. There would be musicians and circus performers. The Khan used silk napkins and the finest porcelain dishware Marco had ever seen. And gifts of gold and silver and gems and jewelry were lavished on those in attendance. Marco describes how some of the Khan's most important advisors and lords received beautiful robes, each with hundreds of pearls sewn into them. It was gaudy and ostentatious and dazzling. And it's not just a fantasy. All these things described by Marco have been confirmed by other historical sources. Now, outside the palace walls, the world Marco Polo encountered was equally amazing. In Khanbalik, Marco spoke of the broad and straight roads, the sophisticated drainage system, a lake stocked with fish, beautiful lawns, trees of all types, and even a zoo filled with all sorts of exotic animals. And Khanbalik was safe, with thousands of sentries patrolling the city and guarding every gate. It was all amazing, and Marco makes no attempt to compare it to any place in Europe. Khanbalik and the great Khan were unequaled in the eyes of the young Venetian. Now, I do want to mention one other thing about Kublai Khan, because it is something Marco goes into detail about, and that is the Khan's family and personal life. Kublai Khan had four wives. His second wife, Chabi, was his favorite and was an important advisor to the Khan. Depending on the source, she is described as a Buddhist or an Nestorian Christian. According to Marco, the Khan had 22 sons by his four wives, plus 25 other sons by his concubines. We don't know about girls, as they were just not important in the eyes of Marco. Now, I do want to mention the concubines because Marco goes into great detail about them. He reported that the Khan would send out agents every other year and find the most beautiful women in the world and bring them back to his court. There would be 400 to 500 of them. These would be rated in dozens of categories, including eyebrows, nose, ears, cleanliness of breath, and even how loud they snored. It was all designed to give Kublai Khan the perfect woman. The great Khan would ultimately settle on 40 of them to be in his harem. These would then be trained to sexually please the Khan. By the way, the girls not selected would be given jobs in the palace or married to one of the Khan's barons. Either way, it was considered an honor for the girl to be selected for such a thing. At least, that is what Marco says. Many years later, when all of this sex stuff found its way to Europe via Marco's book, many people were appalled by these practices. At least publicly, they were appalled. In reality, I get this feeling that most people were like these little kids looking for the naughty parts in a book. They'd search them out, share them with their friends, express their disgust, of course, then read those parts again and wish they had 40 young women in a harem back at their castle. All of this just demonstrates the opulence and grandeur of Kublai Khan's court, and it is something that wowed young Marco Polo. And I want to stress that opulence and grandeur were the order of the day. The Khan led a gaudy and structured and luxurious lifestyle. In his younger years, Kublai Khan had been a warrior of great renown. But now, as he grew older, he reveled in the excesses of his success. He put this on display for his subjects, and it awed many who came into his orbit, including young Marco Polo. And speaking of Marco, we should probably turn our spotlight back on him, as this is his series. So what did Marco do now that he had been introduced to the great Khan? Well, the young Venetian appears to have taken some time to watch and learn. If he didn't know the languages of the court, he began to learn them. This would be Persian and Mongolian. Marco is believed to have learned four languages while he traveled, the aforementioned Persian and Mongolian, plus Arabic and Turkish. And he didn't just learn to speak the language, he learned to read and write them. He then began to learn the customs and habits and culture of the Mongols, who Marco called Tartars. He went hunting with them and would become a huge fan of falconry. And he took to wearing their clothes and participating in their holidays and festivals. In many ways, Marco Polo was the perfect person for this. He was an intelligent and inquisitive young man, which made him open to having all these experiences. An older person, someone entrenched in his or her habits and beliefs, might simply have rejected the Mongol world due to his own biases and views. Instead, Marco embraced the experience and thrived. Now, in addition to learning about life in the Mongol court, Marco came to understand the financial system of the empire. This included paper money, a system virtually unknown in Europe. Marco marveled at the ability of the emperor to simply print money and describes it in detail. This money, by the way, was backed by silver and silk. And with the mention of silk, that is something else that Marco discussed in depth. Silk was one of the great products produced by the Chinese, and it drove much of their economy. Silk, if you don't know, is produced by the silkworm, which only eats mulberry leaves. This was all a huge secret, but even at this time, the specifics of silk production were gradually spreading throughout Asia, into the Middle East, and into Europe. Still, Chinese silk was considered the finest in the world. The Chinese cultivated it on big plantations, the production almost strictly done by women. A single moth could lay 500 eggs before dying. This would produce 30,000 silkworms, which would go on to produce 12 pounds of raw silk. The worms were kept in a temperature-controlled environment, and they were fed hand-picked and chopped mulberry leaves around the clock. It was a process that had been perfected over the centuries and was so secret it was death to reveal the information outside of China, and death to try and smuggle cocoons or eggs out of the country. By the way, the silk thread is rounder and smoother than other fibers, and the thread is, if I understand it correctly, pleated in such a way that it retains dyes better than other fabrics. This allowed the Chinese to make incredibly vibrant silk clothing, banners, and flags. Another thing about silk was that it was incredibly strong, and it was often used to make sails for ships. In the end, silk was a massive driver of the Chinese economy, and Marco would come to understand that. By the way, before we get to Marco's first journey, I want to make a quick note about Niccolò and Maffeo Polo. When Marco sets out on his own, he will barely mention his father and uncle again. What exactly they did in these coming years, we really don't know. So at this point in our story, we do know what was Marco's first mission for Kublai Khan. Marco was to travel to a place called Karajang, a journey of 6 months. Now, for this mission, Marco studied how the Khan reacted to his other agents. And here, Marco's astute observational skills will help him out tremendously. He says that he noticed that the Khan wanted information from his agents. Remember, the Khan was an inquisitive ruler. He wanted details. He wanted to know about novelties and unusual events. He wanted to know if there were natural disasters or if the harvest was good. All that stuff. Thus, Marco prepared accordingly and would go on to be a great taker of notes on his journeys. By the way, it is believed that Marco brought many of these notes back to Venice and would have them sent to him when he was dictating his narrative to Rustichello. This would explain many of the very specific details that Marco was able to provide in his book. Now, Marco does not say anything specific about this first mission, other than that he returned from it successfully, and the emperor was greatly pleased with his service. Thus, Marco probably came back and provided oodles of information for the Khan, telling the emperor in great detail all the things that he had seen and learned on his year-long mission. Who knows, perhaps this was the start of Marco's skill as a storyteller. It's one thing to have a lot of great information, it's another to impart it on your listeners in an entertaining fashion, something that would be a valuable skill for Marco Polo. Ultimately, he understood the value of observation, recording, and reporting. It will make him a favorite of the great Khan. In fact, Marco boasts that many in the Khan's court were jealous of him due to the great affection that Kublai Khan showed toward him. By the way, Marco would eventually, upon returning to Venice, get the nickname Il Milioni, meaning the million. People called him that because so many of his stories had all these outrageous numbers attached to them. 300,000 this, 500,000 that, a million here, 100,000 there. You get the idea. So after the success of his first mission, Marco would be given other duties by the great Khan. When all was said and done, he would spend 17 years as an agent for the Mongol emperor. Now, what does that exactly mean? Well, that's a good question. There is a lot of debate about this, and what Marco says is often unclear, and at times, likely untrue. It is probable that Marco held several positions over the course of his nearly 20 years of serving the Khan, and because he served so long, it's likely that he did these jobs rather well. Marco appears to have been involved in commerce, so many believe that he was a tax collector of sorts. This would have been an important job, but it's also possible that he was simply the Khan's emissary, visiting various kingdoms and lands under the rule of the Khan, and then reporting back whatever he had seen. After all, having a good set of eyes and ears traveling around the kingdom was a valuable thing for the Khan. Now, no matter what the job, he made multiple ventures throughout the empire, and for the rest of this episode, we will focus on one of those missions. This will be a journey from Khan Balik to the far reaches of the empire and beyond to the lands of Tibet, Myanmar, and Vietnam. As I noted earlier, there's a good chance that he went to these places more than once, but wrapped the descriptions of these lands into one narrative. As a note, if you want to see a route to this, which is not a bad thing to do, you can find a map at explorerspodcast.com. Anyhow, here is that story.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Marco Polo, now a servant to the great Khan, would depart from Khan Balik with a golden paisa, a Mongol passport, in his pocket. This would guarantee him safe passage throughout the realm. The paisa was a foot long and 3 inches wide, and read, quote, "By the strength of the eternal heaven, holy be the Khan's name. Let him that pays him not reverence be killed," end quote. Well, that's the kind of thing that'll get you some prompt service. So, about 10 miles outside of the city, Marco described a wondrous bridge that crossed the Yongding River. This bridge was 300 paces long and 8 paces wide. There were 24 archers and 24 piers, and the bridge was constructed of gray marble and granite. Marco called it a masterpiece. The bridge is now famously called the Marco Polo Bridge because of the description provided by Marco in his book. It still exists to this day, although it was partially rebuilt in 1698. Marco's description of the bridge isn't bad. The length, 875 feet, and width, 30 feet, jibe with Marco's assessment. However, the number of arches and piers is actually only 10 and 11, respectively. The bridge, which is also called the Lugu Bridge, features hundreds of artistically unique stone lions on both sides. Riding on horseback, Marco would then head southwest into the heart of China. Now, we mentioned before that Marco Polo and his family were not the first Europeans to reach China. But where Marco was heading was a different story. These were remote lands, and it's conceivable that he was the first European to reach some of these places. This includes the provinces of Sichuan and Yunnan in what is now Myanmar and northern Vietnam. We should note that Marco was not traveling on trails or anything so crude. These were imperial roads, wide and well-maintained and safe, at least at the start. Marco notes that there were distance markers set at exact intervals, giving travelers a way to know how far they had gone or had to go on their journey. After passing through the city of Zhaozhou, Marco would travel 10 days to the city of Taiyuan, about 200 miles from Beijing. The city was the capital of the Shaanxi province, and thus an important trade center. It was famed for its wine and silk production. As a note, as Marco traveled, he would have been treated well by the local people. His paisa would have been like a platinum credit card, good for whatever he needed, wherever he needed it. He would have stayed at the homes of local officials or at a nice inn. Especially in these early stages, it is unlikely that he ever had need for food or shelter. About 10 days later, Marco would come to the Yellow River. This is the second longest river in China and flows to the Pacific. It was a crucial artery in the empire's waterway system, with merchants traveling to and from the interior of China. The river is so wide, Marco said no bridge spanned it. As Marco moved southwest, it was his habit to describe the great cities along its route. For each, he listed the obvious qualities and also the trade goods the area was famed for. Perhaps it was his instincts as a merchant to do this, but it also may have been part of his job. Remember what the Khan likes. Observe, record, and report. And noting all the money-making stuff is probably a high priority on Marco's list. So Marco would continue from the Yellow River and go southwest. Along the way, he talked about the people, saying most of them were idolaters. When he says this, he's talking about the fact that most Chinese, no matter their religion, incorporated some form of idol worship or idol veneration in their lives. So when he talks about idolaters, he means those who practice anything from Buddhism to Taoism to Confucianism to simple folk religion. Next, Marcus would reach the city of Shen in the Shenxi province. I want to stress that these were not small backwater towns. These were sophisticated cities with large populations. In Shen, Marco describes the local ruler's beautiful palace and extensive menagerie of animals. About 150 miles from Shen, Marco would enter a mountainous region, which he would travel through for 20 days. He would then emerge in Chengdu, in the province of Sichuan. Chengdu was a great and ancient city. The young Venetian couldn't help but describe all the wondrous trade goods that flowed through the city. He noted that several rivers flowed through Chengdu and then down to the Yangtze, which was China's biggest river. Again, this made it a critical trade hub. Now, up to this point, Marco's mission had been kind of fun. It's had big cities and beautiful countrysides, mountains and great palaces. But from Chengdu, he headed directly west, and things were about to change as they approached the region of Tibet. Tibet had resisted Mongol rule for decades, but had eventually been subdued. But not before many towns and villages had been decimated. Marco described crossing these lands as dangerous and desolate, saying, quote, "The traveler finds no shelter for at least 20 days," end quote. Now, that's an exaggeration on Marco's part. He goes on to say that he could find small villages and hamlets perched on the mountainsides, but it was a devastated region and was only now recovering. Exactly how far Marco went into Tibet is unknown. Some speculate that he may not have actually reached what is now called Tibet, but instead just passed through the bordering region of northern Yunnan, which had also fought the Mongols for many years. Now, I do want to share with you one of Marco's observations on the sexual customs of the local people. Here, in the place he calls Tibet, he says that for a woman to be a virgin or inexperienced sexually was frowned upon. Thus, travelers were often invited to share the beds of an eligible woman, so long as they did not run off with the woman when they departed the village. Of this custom, Marco says, quote, "For a young gentleman between 16 to 24 years of age, a visit to this country is highly recommended," end quote. Spoken by a young man who probably enjoyed the local customs as often as possible. Anyhow, in these cases, the man traditionally would leave a token for the young woman, who would display that token on her person. The more tokens, the more the woman shows she is desirable as a wife. This is no doubt one of those things that appalled and thrilled people back in Europe. From Tibet, Marco moved back east, first visiting the city of Zikang, a place known for producing salt and gold. Here, Marco again notes the unique sexual customs of the people. He says that the men believed that the gods would reward them for allowing their wives and daughters to have sex with passing merchants. Again, it sounds like Marco enjoyed this custom a lot. Next, Marco ventured south and crossed the Yangtze River and eventually reached the city of Dali in the Yunnan province. Here, Marco was moving into areas that were wilder, often thick with jungles and tangled swamps. He talks about massive snakes, as thick as a cask and 20 and 30 feet long, likely pythons. And the snakes weren't the only terror that he described, as he went into detail about these huge man-eating lizards, aka crocodiles. He even goes on to describe how the locals killed the great beasts. Marco would go further south and west. As usual, he described the people and the animals and all the nifty goods they produced, including gold. The further south Marco went, the thicker the jungles became. He mentions lions, elephants, and unicorns, the latter probably a reference to the rhino. Marco would eventually reach the city of Pagan in what is now Myanmar. The area had only recently been invaded by the Mongols and was likely still in the process of being conquered when Marco arrived. This would be the furthest location away from Kambalik that Marco would travel. It was a distance of nearly 2,000 miles. Marco was actually only about 150 miles from the Bay of Bengal and a few hundred miles from India. It had all been a pretty remarkable journey. Marco next traveled east, again through dangerous and wild jungles. He said he and his party had to sleep on boats on the river, or else be pounced on by lions. A couple of weeks later, he would reach the kingdom of Xiaojigo, which today is northern Vietnam. This was the only place Marco went to that was not part of the Mongol Empire. The Mongols had tried to take the region, but had failed thus far. Instead, Xiaojigo was an independent kingdom that paid a hefty tribute to the Khan. Here, Marco would describe the exotic people and their land. They were famed for their gold, ivory, and spices. The region's king was said to have more than 300 wives, and the people had tattoos all over their bodies, often of dragons and lions and birds. From Xiaojigo, Marco would travel north, eventually reaching the Yangtze River and making his way back to Chengdu. From there, he would retrace his steps northeast for 70 days and return to Khan Balik in the court of the Great Khan. His mission was now over. So there you have it. This was a pretty epic journey, probably 5,000 or more miles. Marco would have traveled through the very heart of China and to its remote borders and returned with some extraordinary stories and experiences. It is likely that he was the first European to reach many of these far-flung regions. So with that journey complete, we will wrap up this episode of our series on Marco Polo. Next time, Marco has some more travels in him, including a journey down the eastern coast of China to some of the most magnificent cities in the world. It will be quite the tale. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Thank you for listening. I will see you next time.